Well, Thea Astley's brilliant career. My title, of course, echoes the title of Miles Franklin's first and famous book, published in 1901, when she was only 21. And in that, for that book, the word brilliant was heavy with irony. In fact, Miles Franklin originally intended it to have a question mark after it, my brilliant career. So even a feminist like Miles Franklin didn't expect it would be easy for a woman in Australia really to have a brilliant career as a writer. But 60 years later, 60 years after Miles Franklin's first book, Thea Astley began her brilliant career. Here we have a list of most, I think, of Thea Astley's awards, one for her writing, taken from that wonderful resource, Auslit, wonderful resource on Australian writing. Thea Astley, A.O., was one of the outstanding Australian fiction writers of the 20th century. Four of her novels, including her last, Dryland, a book for the world's last reader, published in 1999, won the Miles Franklin Prize, the most prestigious of Australia's awards for fiction. And she was awarded many other literary, academic and civic honours during her lifetime, which ended in 2004. Her work is known, I think, best for the mordant irony of her gaze on Australian society, for her sharp yet compassionate portrayal of social outsiders. She can be wildly anarchically funny or wildly savagely serious, but she's never solemn. She's a satirist and a writer who loves to play with language. Her puns are legendary. There's a title of a story in her collected stories called The Salad of the Bad Cafe, for example. So there's her list. She's one of my favourite writers, as you might have guessed, and I recently edited a collection of essays about her and by her with a colleague, Paul Giannone, from Curtin University. We had both presented papers on Thea's novels at a conference in 2004 at which she was to be the distinguished invited guest, but she was too ill to come. Just over a month later, we heard of her death, and so we decided to make this collection of essays to honour her and with the hope that it would encourage teachers to keep setting her novels and stories for students to read. So this is the book, Thea Astley's Fictional Worlds. And I understand that Unibooks tried conscientiously to get some copies to be available tonight, but since it was published in the UK, those copies haven't yet arrived. But look out for them, for it. We collected what we thought were the best essays that had been published about her work, starting back in the 1970s, and we added three of her own essays and an interview, as well as the two papers that we had written in 2004 for that conference. And it's unfortunate that we had to publish it in the UK in this expensive hardback edition, which is really intended for libraries. It's a sign, and I think something we should pay attention to, it's a sign of the hard times in the Australian publishing industry at the moment, where even university publishers are very loath to take on this kind of collection of essays. And that's why we had to send it to the UK for publication. So watch out for Thea Astley's Fictional Worlds, but what the Unibook stall does have at the back there are some of Thea's very best and best-known books which are still in print. And, of course, this is another thing that we were aware of in collecting the collection of essays, that after a writer dies, very often their books go out of print and their literary reputation suffers a period of eclipse. And I think this is happening to some extent with Thea Astley, although I hope it will only be a temporary eclipse and there will be a resurgence of interest. So that's an indication of her successes, of the esteem in which she was held by the literary world. And now I have a treat for you. I have an example of Thea Astley reading one of her stories, just to let you hear, or in some cases to remind you, of the distinctive Astley voice. This recording was made at the Harold Park Pub in Sydney sometime in the late 1980s, where the pub regularly held meetings for writers to read. And she was reading on that occasion with one of her contemporaries, Olga Masters. Olga, like Elizabeth Jolly and Amy Whiting and Jessica Anderson, all members of the same generation as Thea Astley, didn't enjoy a brilliant early career like Thea did. None of these talented women, in fact, published a book until they were in their 50s or even their 60s. It's their careers, their belated careers, that first made me ask questions about Thea's early success. But I'll return to that question later in this talk. So in this recording, Thea Astley's reading from a story called Why I Wrote a Short Story Called Diesel Epiphany. Now, this title says two significant things about Thea Astley's writing. One, that she loves complication, so it's a story about writing a story. And two, that image of epiphany, that, you know, a moment of spiritual enlightenment and grace, expresses a recurring desire for these rare moments that redeem her harsh and sometimes angry view of the human condition. But the story also demonstrates her characteristic humour. It's a story about travel.
Buses are worse in Australia, she starts.
They have a mic and a PR system, and it's like the breakfast show all night, or they play country and western and metal rock, or conduct community things. They crack funny. There was one driver on the Southern Run, he used to say at comfort stops, now don't forget the number of the bus, write it on the back of the person in front of you no matter what their sex, and don't let them out of your sight. I remember a party of lady bowlers, he sang hearty songs with risque choruses non-stop from Gladstone to Brisbane. And another time on the Gold Coast Run, a young man behind, what was it Bob Ellis said about the beauty of the monologue, told his life story loudly to an uninterested grunting passenger. By surface, he covered his life to 18, his father's life to 50, his first six jobs, his father's one job. By Grafton, he'd gone thoroughly into four girlfriends and was metaphysically examining the failure of relationship with his fifth. When this gentle little man across the aisle from me swung round and snarled, forget it, son, and let me forget it too. I can't stand it, he said. I can't stand it another minute. I'll kill him. I'll kill the driver. I'm 71 and I don't have to stand it. And he's still talking. This is the old man. The last time I went to the centre, I told the driver, either you lower that music or you put me off and I'll walk. Right here in the middle of nowhere. And I started to tug at the door and I said, you ought to be ashamed. When the newspapers get hold of this, it won't look too good. An old bloke of 70 put out to walk from Eden as Adder. So then the driver lowered the god-awful music. And then the old man gave up trying to sleep and he told me he had this fantasy about buses that did the Wagner Run and the Brahms Run or something. And he liked to think of all the passengers getting excited when the driver said, now, folks, can we have a bit of hush? I'm putting on the Elgar Second. And all the norms and birds get a little excited and say, shut up, love, it's the Elgar Second. Hey, Ron, did you hear they're going to play the Elgar Second? Then the old man stopped talking suddenly and began to wrestle with his earplugs. I'd like to think he got his dream, but maybe he had to ask to be put off. I'll never know because we got off at Maxville at 4 a.m, and then the horror began from a different angle. We'll leave the key to your room on the table near the office, the hotel had assured us by phone. There was no key. Maybe they've left it in the door, I suggested. Country pubs do that. So we went upstairs, and Jack went down one corridor while I went down another, and I found the door with a key in it, and I opened the door, and I felt for the light switch in one efficient movement, and the naked bulb blazed down and there was this terrible moaning from the bed. And I said, oh God, I'm sorry, and shut the door smartly, and then I realised I'd left the light on, so I had to unlock the door. And the man in the bed let out a sharp cry that cut right through my apology. So I took my humiliation away to the smoking room and lay on the floor with my head on my overnight bag. And after a while, after a long while, Jack came back and he said, hey, there was one door with a key in it. I guess you heard him shouting. I really don't want to think about buses. Trains have the personality, the tension, the romance of all travel, of waiting rooms and tea rooms and the music of the rackety lurch. And with luck, you can sleep on trains. And here's another one. First class this time, somewhere between Augsburg and Nuremberg, and Germany is in darkness. There are lights across the swept fields and the pruned hedgerows. I have a compartment to myself. My bag's on the rack, my shoes off, and I'm hoping to sleep all the way to Hamburg. But just then, one of the attendants comes in to check my ticket. And he's an elderly, frayed man. And despite the pressed affirmations of his uniform, he looks tired, as if perhaps he has done this run too long. He has little English, and I have no German except Lieder titles. But in a major effort to communicate, as we pass through Nuremberg without stopping, I point out at a fierce blaze of town light and neon. "The Meistersinger," I say. His whole body seems to awake as if a finger has prodded nerve spots of his nostalgia. "Opera," he asks, "you like?" I shake my head and say, Lieder, I like Lieder." "Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau," I say hatefully. And then to my surprise, he smiles fully, widely, and leans forward. "Gerard who?" she says. "Elizabeth Schwarzkopf," I offer. It's like a competition. "Hans Hotter," he says. "Irmgard Seyfried," I say. "Annalisa Rothenberger," he says. And I laugh. In Australia, I manage with difficulty, train conductors don't know Annalisa Rothenberger. "Ah," he says, "they know the Beatles. We're filled with mutual delight." On and on the train goes, on and on go we, offering singers' names to each other like small bouquets of respect. Wilhelm Striens, Lottie Lehmann, Crystal Ludwig, Gottlob Frick. I remember the old man on the bus. "Ah," I think is my turn. "Ah."
It's a very Queensland voice, I think, don't you? And if you want to know how the story A Diesel Epiphany goes, then you can read it in her collected stories, of which there are copies up the back. So here we have, as well, having heard the voice, now we see a version of the face. This is taken from a portrait which is held in the National Library, which was done by Anne Clark, an artist who lived in Adelaide for some time. Maybe some of you knew her. And Anne very kindly gave us permission to use her portrait of Thea for the cover of Thea Astley's Fictional Worlds. So you can see it's actually executed in a rather lovely sort of blue and parchment colours. That's just an indication of it that we can use as an accompaniment to this very brief biography of Thea that I'll give you. She was born in Brisbane in 1925, the daughter and granddaughter of journalists. So she always wrote poems and stories, although she claimed that she would have preferred a talent for music, which she loved, as you know, can tell now from that story. Raised a Catholic, her only brother Philip became a Jesuit priest. She was educated at All Hallows Convent and at the University of Queensland. She attended university as an evening student while undertaking teacher training. It was during this time that she was introduced to Clem Christison, a colleague of her father at the Brisbane Courier-Mail and the founder of the literary journal Meanjin Papers. In turn, Clem Christison introduced her to the Bajai group of young writers, where she sometimes read her poems. But that happy state would not last for long. Her first teaching appointment came in 1944, and for the next 5 years, she taught in rural Queensland, in many, many different towns, including Townsville in the far north, the setting for her first novel, Girl with a Monkey, which was published in 1958. After her marriage to Jack Gregson, a divorced man some 10 years older than her, whom her parents deeply disapproved of, the couple moved to Sydney in 1949, where their son Edmund was born in 1955. Thea Astley taught in primary and secondary schools for over 20 years. Then, in 1967, she was appointed to teach creative writing at Macquarie University, near her home in the northern Sydney suburb of Epping. It was one of the earliest such appointments in an Australian university. And so until 1980, she carried on a dual career as both teacher and writer, producing a steady stream of novels and short stories. As she herself said, what else was there for an adult female arts graduate just post-war to do but teach? It was not just post-war either, was it? Yet she's the only major Australian writer of her generation, male or female, to have combined school teaching and writing so consistently and so successfully. She liked to say that the one balanced the other. Perhaps writing became an escape from timetables, chalk, playground duty, glazed class 2F and smart aleck class 5A, she said in an interview. And then she added in one of her few comments on the additional role she carried as wife and mother as well, and an escape from the eternal triangle of meals, brown, green and white. So she clearly wasn't domestically inclined. On retirement, she and her husband moved first to Coranda, near Cairns, in North Queensland, and later to the coast south of Sydney. The 1980s are often seen as a high point in women's writing in Australia, and the critical reception of her work began to be revised in this new context. She had appointments as writer-in-residence, including at several United States universities. She continued to publish highly praised novels throughout this final 20-year phase of her writing life. And as I said, her last novel, Drylands, was also her final Miles Franklin success. After her husband Jack died in 2003, she moved north again, near Byron Bay, where her son and daughter-in-law live. Only weeks before her death, in August 2004, she had entertained a wildly appreciative audience with a reading at the Byron Bay Writers' Festival. That festival now features an annual lecture in her honour. And the first of these lectures was given in 2005 by Kate Grenville, who praised Thea for having led the way among white writers to address the sorry history of colonial race relations, as Kate Grenville herself was about to do, of course, with The Secret River. And we were lucky enough to get this lecture of Kate Grenville's to include in our book. Thanks again to Kate Grenville for that. So as my title signals, Thea Astley was the only Australian woman novelist of her generation to have won early success and to have published consistently throughout the 1960s and 70s, when the literary world was very heavily male-dominated. Entering the fiction lists in the late 1950s, at the time when Patrick White was achieving recognition as an extraordinary talent, must have been somewhat intimidating for a new writer, especially a young woman. Astley admired Patrick White immensely, and they were friends for a time during the early 1960s. She was also a friend of the other great prose stylist of that period, Hal Porter, and later with Tom Keneally, with whom she said she shared jokes, and especially, I suspect, jokes about the Catholic Church. By and large, however, she kept her distance from the literary world during this time, although she undertook to edit Angus and Robertson's annual short story collection, Coast to Coast, in 1970. As a fiction writer, she had few female contemporaries until the 1980s, when, as I said, women finally came to the fore in Australian fiction. She had a lucky start when her first manuscript was commended in the Sydney Morning Herald competition for an unpublished novel. It probably would have been the equivalent to the Vogel Prize today. And it was taken up by the formidable Miss Beatrice Davis, commissioning editor at Angus and Robertson's. At the time, Angus and Robertson was one of the very few local Australian publishing houses, and it had a strong commitment to publishing local fiction and poetry. Thea Astley came to trust Beatrice Davis. She survived a few early knockbacks, and she began to publish a new work every 2 or 3 years, as she would do throughout her career. Her third book, The Well-Dressed Explorer, published in 1962, was awarded the Miles Franklin Prize, as was the next one, The Slow Natives, published in 1965, and the sixth novel, The Acolyte, published in 1972. So this run of major Miles Franklin Prizes was an extraordinary success, unprecedented for a young woman at the time. The Acolyte, I don't know whether anyone... Does anyone know The Acolyte? In this audience? Yeah, it was... She often described it as her favourite novel, the one she enjoyed most writing, the one she even said she wrote most easily. And I think this is intriguing because it's the novel that perhaps most of all displays her stylistic pyrotechnics most brilliantly, and yet with it's a huge challenge to the reader. But it's a key work in another respect, I think. As a study of the Acolyte, for whom the title comes, the Acolyte, not the artist whom the Acolyte served. And so it brings a new dimension, to her fascination with outsiders, with misfits and failures. She said in an interview, "When I wrote The Acolyte, I was getting sick of great men." So she decided to focus on the Acolyte rather than the blind artist whom he served. And it was her usual habit even then, back in the early 70s, to look askance at that male-dominated tradition of lauding explorers and pioneers. She was much more interested in the ones who fell through the cracks. During the 1970s, Astley struck out in several new directions. In 1974, A Kindness Cup was the first of her novels to take an historical perspective on settler-Aboriginal relations. And Hunting the Wild Pineapple and Other Related Stories, published in 1979, was her first book of connected stories, a technique of discontinuous narrative which she later refined and used frequently. In the 1980s, she brought these two innovations together in the book called It's Raining in Mango, Pictures from the Family Album, published in 1987. And this was, I think, her most successful work, where she attempts a less dense linguistic style and a narrative form that gave her the opportunity with this succession of linked stories to revisit favourite characters without having to construct elaborate plot lines of a novel length. And also it gave her the opportunity to include an historical perspective. And I think if you've never read any Thea Astley and you'd like to, I'd recommend It's Raining in Mango as a starter. And fortunately there are a few copies available still in print. There are some there on the Unibooks shelf. So I think that in evolving this kind of it's sort of a novel that isn't a novel that's made up of a series of short stories connected by place and interrelationships among the characters, it illustrates how very highly she regarded the short story form. And she often said that the writers she most admired were all practitioners of this form. She used to mention mostly Americans, Raymond Carver, John Cheever, Carson McCullers, author of The Ballad of the Sad Cafe, that she echoed in her title, and the Canadian writer Mavis Gallant. And of course, the short story is a very intense and succinct art form that leaves a writer vulnerable, she believed, because you have to get it right in such a short space, whereas the novel, she said, has more charity. It covers a multitude of sins because of its length. And indeed, she waxed lyrical about this. She said, novels tend to get untidy around the edges and need their hems taken up. In this interview with Candida Baker, she confessed that for her, the novella was actually the most satisfying form, that, you know, the long story, although, of course, it's a headache for publishers. They hate publishing novellas. But she got over this problem quite brilliantly, I think, with two linked novellas that make up the book called Vanishing Points that she published in 1992. And perhaps the success of Vanishing Points earned her the privilege of having a novella, a long story, published in book form with the one called Coda, which came out in 1994. Along with her adaptation of short stories to the discontinuous narrative form, the other major development in Thea Astley's art during the 1980s was her invention of a female narrator. Now, this may seem an odd thing to pay attention to, but after her first and largely autobiographical novel, Girl with a Monkey, she habitually used a male narrative point of view, believing that no one would read her novels if she wrote from a female point of view. And then, she said, she found herself visited with a female narrator for her 1982 novel called An Item from the Late News. And, she said, I realised I don't know how a woman thought. It's a bit disingenuous of her, but that's what she said to an interviewer. I don't know how a woman thinks. How am I going to write a female narrator? She even went so far as to say that I've been neutered by society, so I write as a neuter. She declared herself to be envious of other women like Helen Garner and Olga Masters, who were now showing that it was possible to write as a woman about, she said, female stuff like meals and pregnancies and orgasms. Never her forte. And she seemed, in this interview at least, to despair of ever being able to change herself to write in a female voice. And yet over the last 20 years of her life, her novels often feature females among their multiple narrators. And with the character of Belle, the protagonist of Reaching Tin River in 1990, and the elderly and wonderfully crazed Kathleen in Coda, she achieves a recognisably female narrative voice. And she has great fun in giving these characters some outrageously feminist comments as well, like Belle's mother on her birth asking, "Is it a boy or a drone?" Or Kathleen commenting on the four ages of woman: bimbo, breeder, babysitter, burden. For herself, Kathleen skipped the grandmother years by evading most of her wealthy daughter's requests for babysitting, and now, at, we think, around 80, now she intends to skip the burden years as well by cutting and running, running away from the terrible place called Passing Downs Old People's Home, where her daughter has dumped her, granny dumping, she calls it, and returning to Magnetic Island, which holds vivid memories of her past. Despite the fact that Astley spent most of her adult life in New South Wales, she always set her fiction in the tropics, mostly in her heartland of Queensland, but also in with A Boatload of Home Folk in 1968 and Beachmasters in 1985 on small Pacific islands, possibly Vanuatu, it's not altogether clear. So Queensland was obviously the place where her imagination dwelt, and some of its significance for her is captured in the essay called Being a Queenslander, which we reprinted in the book. There she says, "Queensland is where the tall yarn actually happens, acted out on a stage where, despite its vastness, the oddballs see and recognise each other." So it's sort of oddball to oddball is her idea of what her vision as a novelist is. Yet while she embraced the regional identity of Queensland, her people and their dilemmas transcend that particularity. And her stories are not at all bush stories in the venerable tradition of Henry Lawson. The people she places in these remote settings are very often urban dwellers on the run, and she satirises their attempts to escape from their failings in the isolation of small inland towns or on the far north coast. In fact, most of her main characters are expatriates or exiles of one kind or another. And as she gradually came to include Aboriginal characters in her stories, they too shared this characteristic of being out of place, but doubly so, displaced in their own country and from their own land by colonialism. And so how am I going to answer my own question about Thea Astley's career? Why did she succeed so brilliantly when so many of her female contemporaries failed in the 60s and 70s even to get published? And what were the fruits and perhaps the costs of that early success? In a writing career of 40 years, she produced a significant body of work that always received the serious critical attention of reviewers and prize judges. And yet this critical success didn't bring her bestseller celebrity. And nor has her work yet received sustained attention from literary scholars of the kind that Patrick White, David Malouf and Peter Carey have received. In fact, our book was the first one exclusively published about Thea's work. This suggests a puzzle about the reception of her work. And not only it doesn't only suggest the obvious point that she's the only female in this lineup of eminent fiction writers, but something about the reception. She's admired for her unflinching confrontations with the violence that human beings commit on one another, both the daily aggressions of class and gender in the suburban and small town life that she favours, and also the violent past and present of colonial racism. And yet, with all this cause for admiration, readers' sympathies may be alienated by her characteristic manner of representing these conflicts with gallows humour and brutal irony. For example, The Slow Natives, that early novel that won the Miles Franklin Prize, a novel which really tapped the pulse of the 60s with its portrait of a strained relationship between a man, Bernard, and Keith, his teenage son. In this novel, irony often sort of lurches into caricature. Iris, the mother of Keith and the wife of Bernard, is consistently presented as a less sympathetic character than her husband. When Keith is told that she's having an affair with Gerald, the father of his best friend, he is appalled and runs away. So Bernard and Iris, the couple, quarrel over what to do. The telephone rings and Iris waits impatiently for Bernard to get rid of the caller. And this is a quote then from the novel. "She had begun a neurotic arrangement of certain weak old fronds that projected from a jardiniere in a manner she classed as Japanese." She had been an Ikebana cultist for a while. "She can work at them for half an hour before she achieves a climax," Bernard used to say unkindly. "Everything seems to be all stamens and pistils and pollination processes. Iris's rage was willing to explode like a wonderful flare that might finally illuminate the tundra of her marriage. End of quote. So you wonder whether she deserves this double dose of scorn, not only from the husband character, but from the narrator as well. And such moments of alienation from that characteristic satirical mode can sometimes be compounded by Astley's dense, elusive language. An example of this comes from later in the same scene of marital quarrel, when both spouses realise that their marriage is loveless. Iris's moment of truth is described in conventional terms. It shatters, quote, the legend of forever and ever, and the lies that women tell each other over coffee about the durability of love within marriage, unquote. But Bernard's realisation is dignified with quite poetic intensity, and this is a quote about Bernard. Since there is a divination that apprehends the hawk about to fall on the branch, or the shadow within shadow, the held breath behind the darkened door, Bernard was able now to recognise that, Gerald or no Gerald, they had separated across rivers and the bridges were crumbled years ago. So it's just to bring out as an example of her complex use of language that also intensifies that differentiated characterisation of the husband and the wife. And yet I think that it was these very qualities of harsh irony and complex language and also very complex narrative structures that do account for the fact that she was the only woman novelist of her generation to have published so successfully throughout the 60s and 70s, when the literary world was, as I said, very heavily male-dominated. She spoke the critical language of satire that seemed at the time, perhaps, to be the only effective response to a society that was so bound to convention and complacency. You think of Patrick White's satires on the mythical suburb of Sarsaparilla that were published then, or think of Barry Humphrey's characters that were developed during this period, and the popularity of satirical review in theatre. But perhaps as our moral and political climate has shifted, her sharp irony seems to have a narrower appeal. And also because her wit is so highly intellectual and depends on readers recognising her allusions to music, literature and religion, it sometimes also loses us as we read. And thirdly, she has never delivered unambiguous moral positions from which we, as readers, can feel certain that we're on the side of the angels. We never quite know where we stand in her writing. So I'd like just for the last few minutes to describe some aspects of Drylands, her last novel, to illustrate this, what I think are both her strengths, but the aspects or features of her writing that perhaps lost her some writers later in her life. We should remind ourselves, of course, that Drylands did win the Miles Franklin Prize. And it does demonstrate these qualities at their most accomplished. She never allows herself to sort of drift into caricature, but it is a pretty harsh and bleak vision. Drylands takes the form of a collection of stories about people living in a small Queensland inland town of that name in the 1990s. The stories form one of those discontinuous narrative structures involving characters who are connected to each other through place, but whose stories are fairly autonomous from one another. The framing narrative is told by a woman called Janet Deakin, a name suggesting perhaps that she's a daughter of one of Australia's founding fathers, Alfred Deakin, I mean, a symbolic daughter. She's a relative newcomer to Drylands who has stayed on there after her farmer husband's early death, running the local news agency. Always a reader, and in her previous life, the manager of a city bookshop, Janet now determines to become a writer. And her material will be drawn from the lives she observes around her in the town of Drylands. Her reflections on the problems of writing fiction in the contemporary world form the main substance of her narrative. The stories, including Janet's own, are all tales of violence, and this violence ranges from the verbal sneers that Janet suffers through arson, bashings, domestic violence, and attempted rape. Another woman is victim not to violence but to domestic servitude to her husband and her six sons. She successfully runs away. There are male victims too. A corporate whistleblower fleeing from the city in fear for his life. A failed farmer whose hand-built boat is incinerated by the same resentful youth who insults Janet. and Benny, an Aboriginal man who is hounded first out of his home and then out of his camp in the national park by that youth's father. In each case, the victim finally flees from Drylands, except for Benny, whose relation to the place, of course, is different. It was, after all, his ancestral country. And as Drylands dwindles to a ghost town, Janet too, her shop and writing table trashed, joins the other escapees. Well, the Miles Franklin judges, declaring Drylands joint winner in 2000 with Kim Scott's novel Benang, praised the book as trademark Astley, written with her usual concision, bite and linguistic verve, which brilliantly transcends the darkness at its heart. But despite the award and the praise, Drylands didn't please some of its reviewers. While one of them said he enjoyed the savage and almost despairing vision of life in a small town, which expertly demolishes several hoary national myths, others lamented its negativity. They reacted against the excessively bleak and violent picture of small town life. And two male reviewers complained that the novel failed to take its anger and despair anywhere because its characters could not develop, falling as they did into two simple categories of bullies, mostly male, and victims, mostly female. Well, the violence is, and there is no doubt about this, perpetrated by white males, either the Brycelands, father and son, who virtually own the town, or the two jocks from the pub who stalk and terrorise Joss, the publican's wife, or passers-by, like the literate would-be rapist, the commercial traveller. In every case, the victims of violence are women, or else nonconformist men, that is, men who are feminised in a way, in the sense of being dreamers or truth-tellers, or, in Benny's case, Aboriginal. Each story tells of an act of violent cruelty committed out of no particular motivation, as far as we can tell, except that the perpetrator can and does get away with it. And it's hard not to see this as a deeply ironic comment on Australian nationalist themes of mateship and pioneering virtue. But when asked about the bad behaviour that she portrayed in this novel, Astley simply remarked that in small communities, people's transgressions and misdemeanours merely show up more. They can't hide them. But although she declined to apportion blame or explain the violence, her comment does suggest that the dying town of Drylands should be seen as a microcosm of the larger society. That is, I think that the bleak inland country town is obviously, well, it's quite obviously part of one nation, a redneck backwater, where the white patriarchs still rule, and a town of the kind that most of us city dwellers can comfortably distance ourselves from. But it should also be seen, I suspect, as the essence of settler Australia, with all its features writ large. So that's like the small town as a microcosm of the larger society. As Evie, the travelling creative writing teacher, discovers, she is just as vulnerable to male violence as Ro, the battered housewife in her class, whom she has pitied. Drylands is merely the location of Evie's more general discovery about violence. And also, though it's undeniably Australian, what Drylands represents is not confined to Australia. Plugged into a satellite world of videos and sport, the blokey community is global as well. Clem, the American landlord of the Legless Lizard Pub, that's a classic Astley name, the Legless Lizard Pub, quite nostalgically enjoys this global mateship until his wife is driven out of town and he must choose to follow her or lose her. Drylands gives a grim political view of our society, matched by personal stories of suffering. Some readers who enjoyed Astley's ironies and her wild humour in other works confess themselves disappointed here. But yet there is energy and there is a satisfying kind of irony in little touches like Fred, the wandering husband and father of six, who is literally left holding the baby. The baby's left on his doorstep by his latest girlfriend, and he pleads with his wife to come back and help him look after not only the six boys, but now this baby as well. Oh, she says, "What? That the line's bad, I can't hear you." She's found herself a job over on the coast. And there's also satisfaction in witnessing Benny, the Aboriginal man, in triumph when he publicly claims literal brotherhood with his tormentor, the rich and powerful Mr. Bryceland. Benny knows full well that they had the same father. And there are intimations of redemption from this bleak state of being, as each escapee from drylands heads for the coast. There's a sort of freedom and a spaciousness about escape, and the beauty of the coast acts as a counterweight to their former imprisonment in drylands heat, its shabby small rooms, the noisy pub, the failing farms. Here's Janet about to leave at the very end of the novel. There was a house she had seen once in a tiny, forgotten settlement on the edge of a coastal lagoon somewhere north of Brisbane. Its two stories listed towards the sea. Its cockeyed roof was as insolent as a navvy's cap. There was a name on a board beside the front door, Bateau Ivre. And the house, the name, the memory of the lonely sandshore with its dripping she-oaks had stayed with her over the years. Rambo, miles from anywhere. Refinding it would be like the search for the ultimate Eden. Now, it's true that these images occupy only fleeting moments in the book's time frame. They may be only dreams, only illusions. Eden is a moment of epiphany. Remember the story that we heard earlier with the moment of epiphany. And as such, not a dramatic enough subject in itself for this tough and intelligent writer. She would go for the drama, not for the moment of grace that might follow the drama. Thea Astley demands a lot out of life, out of herself and of her readers. And for exactly that reason, I don't think we can afford to let her novels fade out of sight. Thank you.